Episode 95 of Ask the Inspector. It's September 5th, 2023. Jeff Norman in California for just a few more days. And Scott Ritter in Del Mar, New York. Just back from Switzerland. Did my favorite weapons inspector have a fruitful and enjoyable trip?
I actually did. It was a fantastic trip. I was there as a guest of a conference run by an organization. The Swiss term is Mut zur Ethik, and it means to be courageous in the execution of ethical duties and responsibilities, something of that nature. But they've been around for 30 years. They've been meeting on a regular basis. It is a well-oiled machine that they're running, meaning they know what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Judging by that mission statement, it sounds like it's broader than just military affairs, just war and peace. It's all kind of ethical issues.
Oh, I would say that military is probably the least of their things. Half of them are seem to be teachers, and the other half seem to be medical professionals, doctors, psychiatrists, etc. But all of them are concerned Swiss citizens who are worried about humanity. So, inviting me introduced a military dynamic, especially from an American point of view, that might otherwise be missing from their show. But they're very worried about international affairs. They're worried about the role of America in the world today, the pressure that's being placed on Switzerland by America. They have a very cool thing in Switzerland that we Americans could learn from them. It's called direct democracy. Think of a Vermont town meeting writ large. Basically, if the government does something the people don't like, people can get 100,000 signatures. There's a referendum, and they get the vote. And if the people win, it becomes the law. Pretty cool stuff. But the other thing that Switzerland is very proud of is their neutrality. Well, they're also proud of their chocolate. I found out they're pretty proud of their cheese too.
Their wine?
Well, yes, Jeff, but you didn't put me in contact with the Swiss wine person, so I couldn't find out about their wine. But I guess they like their wine. They like their beer. They're pretty proud of everything. I mean, Switzerland has a lot to be proud of. It's a pretty cool country. But neutrality is something that they feel is very much under attack. And so my next Substack article, which unfortunately I couldn't get done in time for this show because I was sort of traveling till late last night, but will be about in defense of Swedish neutrality and how that's actually Swiss neutrality, and how that would be a very good thing for American national security. We need a neutral player out there. So I'll just go ahead and move my head here. I don't know if you can see right there, that white thing.
Yeah,
the black circle. That's a gift from them. It's actually a very, very pretty cutout. One of their members cut it out by hand. It's sort of an outline of all things Swiss. But thank you very much for that, guys.
There, do you want to move your head one more time? Now we can get a more of a better shot. Okay. Nice haircut, too.
It's still left over from the wedding. It's just growing in.
All right. Well, this is the lightning round, and that means Scott answers all questions in 3 minutes or less, and the whole show is an hour. Friday night is the loquacious version for 2 hours, and Scott gets into things much more extensively. And one of the comments is they don't like our new format of doing only about the first 20 minutes on YouTube before switching to, or not switching to, but just staying with Rumble and the other channels. Well, if you have another suggestion on how to overcome the censorship of YouTube, let us know. That's why we're doing it. But we are open to tweaking it. It's an ongoing effort to do the best we can. All right, so let's start with our first question. Well, hold on, as usual. I'm alone. Anne's not here. Bear with me, please. Let me do this. There we go. Drew from Lake District in the United Kingdom. After your trip to Russia, you reported that the Russian people had little nostalgia for Soviet times. How do you feel they process these times with leaders such as Stalin? I'd be very interested to know how Putin explains this. Are there any books or documentaries you know of?
I mean, I'm positive, given the intellectual capacity of the Russians and their interest in their own history, that there are certainly books and certainly documentaries, but I can't quote any off the top of my head. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has addressed the issue of Russia's Soviet past and the issue of Stalin several times. The history is the history. They don't want to go back to Soviet times, but I think many Russians are proud of what Stalin accomplished, but shamed by the excesses of the Stalin era. I think you'll find a wide difference of opinion on that issue. Just how much shame they feel. Some are extraordinarily proud. I mean, they look at their history, and remember, Russians know their history. They've got a different perspective of their history than we in the West do. For instance, while the United States was justified sending thousands of troops to Russia in 1918, 1990, 19, pulling them out in 1920, I don't know if many Americans know that, but we actually invaded Vladivostok. We sent troops on the Trans-Siberian Railroad all the way to Irkutsk and Omsk. We sent troops up in Murmansk and Arkhangel and fought very bloody fights with the Bolsheviks on Russian soil, by the way. So we were the invaders. So while we're wrestling with that aspect of it, they're wrestling with the fact that it wasn't just the United States doing this, but Great Britain, France, Japan, basically the whole world was trying to destroy the Soviet Union in the aftermath of the Russian revolution and the Soviet Civil War. So the Russian Civil War. So when Lenin died, it was a country that was fairly weak. If people remember their Russian history or the Soviet history, Lenin had to sort of walk away from his, Marxist utopia and re-embrace a form of capitalism, the new economic plan, NEP, that he started to implement. And, that didn't work. Stalin came in, had to deal with the failing Soviet economy, many enemies, and he rebuilt the Soviet Union. His methodologies were tough, but he had no choice. It was because of what Stalin did in the 30s that the Soviet Union was able to survive the German invasion of the 40s. And Stalin put the Soviet Union on the path towards the greatness or relevance that they were able to assume in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. So I think that the Russians love Vladimir Putin. They understand his role in history, how he dragged him out of the 90s into the modern era. I think many Russians see a parallel with what Stalin did with the Soviet Union.
All right, that's the sound of the whip. We are very strict disciplinarians here if Scott exceeds the 3-minute time limit. With his consent, by the way. I want anybody telling me I'm being mean to Scott. It's with his consent.
You're being mean to me, Jeff.
The brewmaster in Wisconsin, Tucker Carlson, said this week there will be a hot war between the United States and Russia in the next year. They, meaning those currently in power, need to declare war footing in order to assume war powers in order to win. Do you agree with his assessment?
Not just no, but hell no. With all due respect, Tucker, if you're watching, you got my phone number. You've called me in the past. You should have called me on this one before opening your mouth. The premise of your concept is that if we assume war powers acts, we would be able to win a war with Russia. You're just dead wrong, Tucker. We can't win a war with Russia. We can't win one conventionally. We can't win one nuclearly. It doesn't matter war powers. It doesn't matter what we do. We can't win. So it's stupid to even talk about the inevitability of a hot war. Where are we going to fight this hot war, Tucker? Syria? You really think that America is going to hook and jab with Russia over Syria? We're going to fight it in Ukraine? You really think America is going to put boots on the ground in Ukraine? Which general would sign off on that one, Tucker? Which general? With what brigades? What strength? You don't know anything about war, Tucker. talk to Colonel McGregor again. He will talk you through this. And if he doesn't have the time for you, I'll make the time for you. But you're just wrong on this one, Tucker. We're not going to go have a heart war with Russia because the generals know we can't win. So they're not suicidal. And in any case, your premise that somehow war powers authority to our executive saves the day is fundamentally flawed. We don't have the military capacity to defeat Russia in a large-scale ground conflict in Europe. End of story. I beat the whip.
All right. Very emphatic. You left no doubt where you stand on that issue. No doubt at all.
Probably burned my bridges with Tucker, too, but you know, it is what it is.
He appreciates that you're a principled man. Don't you worry about a thing. Axel in Finland. How is Ukraine and the West keeping up with the ammunition and equipment supplies? How are the M777s repaired and where? Same with the ANTPQ-36 radars. Axel's just showing off, I think, at this point with all this jargon. It seems Russia has destroyed more than the West has supplied.
Well, I mean, first of all, the West has supplied quite a few. If you go back and start counting up the tally from the moment we started supplying the M777s, there we go. That's a 155 millimeter towed howitzer.
I knew that, of course.
Yeah. And the ANTPQ-36 radar is a counter battery radar used to track artillery shells when they're fired from enemy artillery, and then you get the reverse azimuth onto the exact location where they came from so that you can fire artillery shells and hit them and kill them, counter battery fire. So good job, Axel. Right up on that kind of stuff. He's testing me because, see, I say that I was an artillery guy, but I actually used the ANTPQ-36 over and over again. I didn't use the M777. We were self-propelled artillery back then. The M777 cannot be maintained in Ukraine, and it is a maintenance-heavy piece of equipment. It's not just that if you fire it a lot, you're going to get cracks in the titanium. You're going to get leakage in the special nitrogen gas that's used in it. You're also going to burn out your barrels, and the Ukrainians have been burning out their M777 barrels quite a bit. So the M777s have to be pulled out, sent back, and my guess is that they are repaired in Germany, where the United States Army has a depot that's capable of doing that. They may have forward deployed that to Poland and are doing it on Polish soil, which saves a lot of transit time, would be the smart thing to do. The same thing with the ANTPQ-36. If it receives battlefield damage and it is repairable, it would be withdrawn from the battlefield and taken to a repair depot. But the fact of the matter is, you know, let's say we provided them 120 M777s, just without the Russians killing any, you're going to see 50% of those somewhere in the maintenance cycle, being withdrawn, being repaired, being brought back, which means they only have half of those available on the battlefield. And the Russians are taking them out every day using their Lancet loiter munitions and other counter battery techniques. So I would be surprised if the Ukrainians have a quarter of the M777s that we originally provided. And again, just throwing out a number there, it's called 120. I think it's more than that, given that other nations provided them too. But a quarter of 120, 4, 8, 12. Nope, that's a third. So now we go to 3, 6, 9, 12, 30. So they have 30 left, and 15 of those are in the maintenance cycle. That means they got 15 M777s able to bring fire to bear on the front lines. That's a rough guesstimate, but that's a lot less than 120.
All right, I could go on and on about the M777s, but since we have limited time on Tuesdays, I'll just move on to...
Hey, that's for the loquacious time, Jeff.
Yeah, right. Loquacious one. Don't get me started on the M777s. We have a voicemail message from Anya in Serbia.
Hello, this is Anya from Serbia. And
I told you.
As a religious follower and subscriber to all of Scott Ritter's channels, podcasts, and all the podcasts he regularly appears in, such as U.S. Store of Beauty, etc. I'd like, first of all, a happy birthday from Scott, because my birthday is going to be on September 6th. if that's possible. And second of all, does Scott still think that the collapse of the Ukrainian army is going to take place late this summer or early this fall? Has he not changed his stance on that? Many warm regards and keep up the good work.
Happy birthday to Anya from Serbia. Happy birthday, Anya from Serbia. One day early, because today is, of course, September 5th. But because we don't broadcast on the 6th, if we waited till the 7th, which that would be the 8th, my calendar's off. I've been traveling. You guys have to forgive me. My head's still
You're loopy from jet lag.
I'm somewhere in Zurich. But happy birthday, Anya. First of all, thank you very much for all the kind words you've said about the work that Jeff and I do, and that I do with others. And I'd like to believe that it isn't just my charming good looks and dashing character that attracts you, but the quality of the presentation and intellectual stimulus that's provided. But thank you. And now,
all right, I'm going to begin the 3-minute timing now, by the way, just so you know. Since it was a birthday thing, I let it go. Now we start. 3 minutes. Go to her question. You remember the other question?
I do, but I mean, just a second. Just a second. You shouldn't let me read. You should order me to stop reading comments, because some people just really get me angry.
All right, I'll stop the clock. Which time?
No. The talk watcher, Scott. Spare us from having to hear him sing happy birthday. Him is who, Jeff or me? Because you know what? The talk walker, Jeff, are you ready? You ready for this one?
Yeah, well, I'm ready, but I'm looking.
Happy birthday to Anya from Serbia. You're singing, Jeff, to Anya from Serbia. Happy birthday
to Anya from Serbia.
This is for Talk Watcher, because you didn't want to hear us sing. Stick in your ear. Okay. Sorry. Don't tell us what to do, man. This is our show. We can do whatever we want to do. If you don't want to watch it, click. Okay. But I'll make this pretty easy. I still believe very much that the Ukrainian army is going to suffer some sort of military collapse by the end of summer, early fall. Having said that, it's an assessment. I could be wrong, but I'm just looking at the casualty rates. I'm looking through the burn rate of their strategic reserves, and I'm starting to see the Russians beginning to carry out localized counterattacks to which the Ukrainians don't have a response. And if they do this on a large scale and there aren't any Ukrainian forces to respond to that, thus begins the process of collapse. But it's an assessment. We'll see. I don't have the totality of information that one would normally want to have to be comfortable with such an assessment, meaning, is it possible the Ukrainians are sitting on another 30, 40,000 well-trained reserves that can fill the gap? It's possible. I don't know where they are, if they do exist. But I'm still going with that assessment. And happy birthday again, Anya, from Serbia.
Yeah, happy birthday, Anya. The things that set you up, I love it.
I don't mind nice people saying, "Hey, Scott, really, man, your voice would crack cement." Okay, I'm with you on that one. But when you're snide and mean like that, especially since Anya was so nice and she asked for us to sing happy birthday, I mean, she didn't ask us to sing happy. She asked us to wish her happy birthday, but you're the one who injected singing. So,
yeah, a killjoy. That guy's a killjoy, really. All right. So, at this time, I'm going to ask the YouTube audience to follow us over to Rumble. In the chat box, the link to this exact podcast, this episode streaming live right now, you can find it in the live chat box, or just go to our channel, rumble.com/US Tour of Duty, and you'll be able to find it. If you can't watch Rumble, for example, if you're in France, Rumble is not available in France, or for some reason you don't want to watch it on Rumble, go to scottritter.us, and we'll have links there to all our channels where we're streaming live right now, including Twitch, Twitter, Rumble, Locals, and Facebook. This is to escape the censorship of YouTube. So at this time, we will say so long to our YouTube audience. And now we
so long, YouTube audience.
Now we can go nuts. Are you ready to go nuts?
I didn't go nuts on the last one.
Well, they're not going to censor us for scolding.
They might censor me for singing, though.
Yeah, that's true.
That is a violation of so many community standards. It's not even funny.
All right. Let's go on to the next question. This is from Finn in Norway. Could the Russian defense lines be compared to a lobster trap where you can get in but not out? You mentioned at one time that the lines were constructed so that the Ukrainians should break the first line. And second, what are your favorite peace songs?
Well, Finn from Norway, I like the idea of the lobster trap because pretty much if you take a look at the way it works, if you read Lieutenant General Alexander Romanchuk's paper in which he, I think it was published last March in a Russian defense journal, where he describes the defensive doctrine that he rewrote, reworked, that's being employed today in Zaporizhia. Basically, the idea of the defense is to allow the Ukrainians or the attacking force to shape the battlefield so that they go where you want them to go. Meaning that if they want to use the military force necessary to push forward, that you give them that opportunity, but you do it where you want so that they come through and they get into what they call a cauldron or a fire sack, where you pound the living dog poop out of them while you're pincing off their avenue of retreat. Now you've trapped them. And I mean, I'm going to write General Romanchuk, and I'm going to say the new term for this should be lobster trap. And what I have to do is show enough integrity to say that, General, I didn't come up with it. Finn from Norway did. But you should call it. I like that. That's a really cool idea. Yes. Favorite peace songs. I like Cat Stevens' Peace Train. I think that's a cool song. It's about peace. To me, peace is also anti-war. And I'm a huge fan of Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. I think it's one of the most crushing songs ever written about the consequences of sending young men off to fight and die overseas. I really like the version that he performed live in Japan with the orchestra backing him up, but any version of that song is good. Yeah, that's it. And it is a hard rain that's going to fall. War is a hard rain, and it is going to fall, and you're going to pay the price. But those jump out at me. Peace Train is sort of a very happy song. Makes me feel good when I listen to it. Hard Rain is going to fall is the opposite of happy. Makes me feel pretty sad when I listen to it, but sometimes you got to listen to it anyways just to reflect on what it is. You know, sometimes we spend a lot of time talking about war. For instance, Anya asked from Serbia, happy birthday again, Anya, asked a question about, you know, timelines for the end of the war, collapse. And we use terms like collapse and maneuver and all that stuff. But when we say collapse, it means that it's because many thousands of Ukrainian soldiers would have died, and thousands of Russian soldiers would have died killing them. War is about humans killing humans, and sometimes we need to be reminded of the human cost. We're going to fall reminds us. Ouch, Jeff. Ouch.
All right. I forgot the name of it, but one of Scott's previous Substack posts is devoted to his favorite anti-war songs. He was a guest on Malcolm Burns' great radio show, Long Way Around, and he took the time to write about each one, what each one means to him. And I knew that the Dylan song was one of them. That's why I had it ready to go. And then another one that you mentioned in that article was this one. This is a different version than the one that you embedded, but same idea.
And I just turned 22.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering what did you do And the closer they got, the more those feelings grew.
I just want to warn you, Jeff, that Marina's watching this, and she absolutely hates Neil Young. Oh. I don't know how we stayed married for 32 years, and I love Neil Young, and she just like, ah.
Well, I absolutely hate him on a personal level because of the censorship stance he took when Spotify signed Joe Rogan. He said that he called for a boycott of Spotify just for simply having the Joe Rogan podcast.
But it's hard to that good music transcends politics.
Yeah, right. That's true. Bruce Springsteen.
You're hurting me, man. You're hurting me because
the thrill is gone. The thrill is gone with Springsteen.
Not the thrill. I could still be thrilled with the music, but the mystique is gone.
Yeah, well, the live show, the thrill is gone. Anyway,
well, I'm not paying $5,000 to watch that.
Yeah. Paul D. Wolf, we're not pissed at YouTube. We're just simply complying with their requirements. They censor us. So why would we want to just have the content removed?
Jeff, speak for yourself. I'm still pissed.
All right, you're still pissed. Well, there's more to it than us being pissed. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. Yeah. We're not that simple.
Yeah, whether or not we're pissed, they're going to censor us. So we don't. People, I see some of the comments, people are saying, oh, just let them censor it and embarrass them. But if they remove the channel, how do we accomplish anything by doing that? I am a donut in Germany. Can one say that the exceptionalism of the U.S. neocons and that of their European vassals is itself an expression of a Nazi ideology? How else can you evaluate the statements that it is a good investment if only Ukrainians die but no U.S. soldiers?
I would say it's an expression of hateful ideology, whether or not that automatically equates to Nazi ideology is probably a little bit more complex analysis that I'm not prepared to engage in right now because I only have 3 minutes and Jeff's going to beat me up. Just quick, since I have 3 minutes, I'm probably down to 2 minutes and 20 seconds. You brought the donut thing's funny because, again, in Switzerland, you know, we have the U.S. ambassador, Scott Morris, I think his name is. And Switzerland's a very conservative country, very conservative country. And he is, of course, a homosexual proponent of LGBTQ policies, etc. And he made, I have to double check on this because I'm old and senile, but I think he made a comment about Switzerland is the hole to the European donut or something like that, just an insult to them. So I was taken by the guy's reference to donut. Look, it's odious. It's disgusting. It's I can't come up with enough negative, superlatives to emphasize how wrong it is, how cowardly it is for America to be willing to let Ukrainians die to the last Ukrainians to pursue a policy that benefits Americans simply by killing Russians. It is disgusting. And for America to be pursuing that means that America is so far removed from the ideals and values we are supposed to embrace as a nation. I know we don't. I study American history as well as anybody else, and I don't need you to remind me of all the sins of our past. They are many. They are continuing. I know what we have done and I know what we continue to do, but I also know what we could be and what we purport to be and what we want to be, at least what I want to be. And this concept of allowing the Ukrainians to fight to the last Ukrainian just because it prevents American boys from coming home in body bags is sickening. I don't know if I'd call it Nazi-like, but it's as sickening as anything the Nazis stood for.
Odious.
Somebody's asking how to ask a question here.
You just did.
The same way. Yeah, the same way. You just did it. Go right to the question itself. No need for the preamble. No need.
Try it again, Princess, and I bet you we answer it.
Because better I know, be good. It better be good after.
I know the producer. I have insight.
Yeah. That question was directed to the moderator. Who's the moderator? There is no moderator. It's me today. Anne is not with us on Tuesdays for the time being. She has a day job.
She has a real
hopefully
job.
She'll be back soon. And so please bear with me if I'm not getting to all the questions with the sort of alacrity with which you've become accustomed. Alacrity. Jamie from Oregon. What would Russia do if NATO were to use a mini nuke?
Russia would use mini non-mini nukes. It would be the end of the world. Russia doesn't believe in limited nuclear warfare. Russia doesn't believe in escalate to de-escalate. And if NATO were to use a nuclear weapon against Russia, Russia would retaliate with the totality of its nuclear force. It's not me saying that. Vladimir Putin has made that quite clear. So it's time for NATO, the West, the United States to clear their minds of any false notion that there is such a thing as usable nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear war, limited nuclear war. No, there's only nuclear war, and it will be total, and everybody will die. And that's just the straight up truth.
Somebody on Rumble is asking, is a mini nuke still as powerful as Hiroshima?
Could be a mini nuke is a dial a nuke, meaning that you can basically take the, it has a maximum potential, and then you can basically dial it down to small. The W-76-2, which I believe is on the currently mounted on Trident submarines on board the Ohio class submarines patrolling the world, can actually be as small as a tenth of the Hiroshima bomb, because there might be targets that only need that much nuclear power. So yeah, they can come in smaller than the Hiroshima weapon. They could also come in a lot larger than the Hiroshima weapon.
All right, the princess has gotten to the question, and lest there be any doubt, in capital letters is the word question. We would not have recognized it otherwise. What do you think about North Korean Kim and Mr. Putin meeting up? Sounds like sort of a scary development.
What do I think? I think that Kim Jong-un is the leader of a sovereign state that we know as North Korea, and that Vladimir Putin is the leader of a sovereign state that we know of as Russia. And I think as leaders of the respective sovereign states, they could behave in a sovereign fashion. I mean, if they want to meet, that's their business. You know, so be it. I don't think it's Russia's business, whoever we meet with. And I don't think it's North Korea's business, whoever we meet with. But what could be scary about North Korea? I mean, Russia already has a nuclear arsenal that's capable of destroying the United States 100 times over. So becoming close to North Korea doesn't give any enhancement on the nuclear side. Some people say that North Korea is going to sign an arms deal with Russia. Fact is, Pixel Fund supporter says, not really, it's just an arms deal. Well, let me put it this way. I don't believe Russia is buying arms from North Korea. Why? Because what arms would Russia buy from North Korea? Some people say, well, ammunition, of course. I think the Russians have an ammunition industry that's producing sufficient quantities of ammunition of the quality that the Russian military insists on. And the last thing Russia would do is subordinate, an important aspect of their ability to wage war the way they want to wage war by allowing another nation to become a major supplier of the ammunition they must have to sustain operations on the battlefield. Why would you put yourself in a situation where you become dependent upon North Korean ammunition? And therefore, for whatever reasons, if that ammunition supply is somehow shrunk or blocked or is no longer there, you're in trouble. Russia doesn't operate that way. It's a big country, big sovereignty issues, and they'll answer their own supply issues. But I do think that Russia and North Korea are sending a signal to the United States, especially the Biden administration, that the Biden administration screwed up. They had a chance to sit down and continue the face-to-face discussions. And by the way, Princess, did you think it was scary when Donald Trump met with Kim Jong-un once, not twice, but three times? Was that scary? It's called diplomacy. And right now, Vladimir Putin's doing a pretty darn good job of being a diplomat. He's meeting with Kim Jong-un. What they're going to be talking about is their business, not our business. And it's the natural state of affairs. That's what neighbors should be doing, talking to one another. North Korea shares a common border with Russia. It seems like sound policy that North Korea and Russia talk things out.
All right. We have a voicemail message from, I think the name would be pronounced Dejan, D-E-J-A-N, from the Republic of, and I'm not even going to try this. It should be illegal to have five consonants in a row. Five. I have no idea. I bet you can do it, though. S-R-P-S-K-A.
Srpska. I know where he's talking about the republic within Bosnia. That's the Serbian dominated mini republic.
Srpska. Okay, here it is.
Hi, Scott. First of all, thank you for your valuable work and insights. I've been following your show and the questions people ask you closely. I have a question to enhance your show's focus. So have you considered dedicating episodes to single topic, allowing for more in-depth coverage in, for example, 5 to 15 minutes, and then engaging with live chat for related questions? I believe this approach could help filter out questions that might not align with your primary domain expertise. So how do you feel about this approach for improving the show's effectiveness? Thank you from there. Bye.
How do you feel about devoting the entire show to one question or one issue?
Well, you know, you and I have been talking about how we can improve the show or diversify the show, enhance the show. I sort of like the idea. I mean, there are some issues out there that are complicated, multifaceted, and deserve to be dug in a little bit detail. So if it was something that we could do, for instance, if we announced in advance, you know, that on this date we're going to do that, so people submit your questions for the show. You're the producer, Jeff. I'm the talent, you know, so I don't really have a vote. I'm just a pretty face that shows up. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was an interesting idea. Also, I wanted to ask you how you feel about Twitter Spaces. I don't know how many times you've done it, but I've heard you do it twice. And before I interject my opinion on it, how did you like the format, the way it went, and so forth?
I mean, I like the concept. I'm not against the concept. You know, it's audio only, at least the way I operated. There was no...
Right. But what about the way they took questions from the audience and what those questions were, that the interaction part of it?
The problem with Twitter Spaces is there's no filter and there's no quality control. Some questions are outstanding. Some questions aren't outstanding. I mean, at least on Ask the Inspector, you go through the questions and you filter out, you know, things of that nature. I think Twitter Spaces sometimes run the risk. Now, they have good moderators. I have to say, everyone that I've been on has been well moderated, and they have intervened very diplomatically to, you know, to preempt a question if it's an inappropriate question or, you know, too long or whatever. But
well, the reason I asked Scott is because I'm looking into taking phone calls, which we've tried before, but there's technical difficulties, and I'm still trying to overcome them. And my thought was, if we can overcome those technical difficulties, we could do a better version of Twitter Spaces in at least one respect. We'd have video in addition to audio. I don't understand why people think it's satisfactory to have only audio. As far as filtering the questions, well, we can't solve that problem. But maybe if the whole thing isn't devoted to phone calls, and sort of like what we do now, we take a combination of questions submitted in advance and some that are coming in live. So that was my thought.
Again, I'm not against it. I think we know what the pitfalls could be. Somebody hijacking the platform to, and that becomes disruptive. And
It's easy enough to hang up on somebody if they do
right,
that.
But then we have a whole show of hanging up on people.
Oh, yeah. All right. Let's go on to our next question from Percival Farquhar in York, Pennsylvania. The former head of the OPCW, Jose Mauricio Bustani, was interviewed by The Intercept, where he talked about his illegal outing by John Bolton, who even threatened his children because of his refusal to corroborate the U.S. false cause for war against Iraq. Were you familiar with the situation during your tenure as a weapons inspector?
To be honest, when I look at the dates, my understanding is that first of all, I'm very familiar with the situation today. When I became aware of this is another question. I was singularly focused on carrying out my task as a weapons inspector in Iraq. And that was a full-time job that required me to travel all around the world, go to Iraq, et cetera. So, you know, from my perspective, the OPCW, the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, didn't have a vote. They weren't players, so I just didn't care about them. They didn't matter to me. I know what he was trying to do. He's trying to say that because weapons inspectors weren't in Iraq operating, the OPCW could come in and fulfill that part of the thing. And yes, Samir, I am wearing a Big Lebowski t-shirt because I'm just that cool. But I actually like
the shirt. The dude will abide.
The dude will abide, and that aggression will not stand. But you know, the thing is, I was a Clinton administration person. I resigned during the Clinton administration, and I believe that Bolton was, of course, during the Bush administration. So the timelines didn't overlap. So I wasn't aware of it while I was an inspector. I was aware of it while it was happening. And then later on, I've spoken with people who were involved, and it's disgusting what John Bolton did. Horrible. But it shows that the United States has become a nation that's not about ideas or ideals, but a nation that uses brute force to get what it wants. And what Bolton did to Mr. Bustami is criminal. And I really, it would just please me to no end if he were held criminally liable for his actions. But then again, as a U.S. government official carrying out the official policies of the United States, he will claim qualified immunity.
Odious.
All right, well, hang on. Remain calm, everybody. Remain calm. Olivier from Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. In the Indian Ocean? Well, maybe near the Indian Ocean. Who knows?
That's it. It's quickly being consumed by the Indian Ocean because of climate change here.
Maybe Olivier's on a boat. Putin is ruling Russia in dictatorial manners when it comes to his political opposition. Russians with different political views on his reign are heavily pursued and jailed, and people who have an opposite opinion to the so-called special operations live in fear and are tracked. What do you say about this?
Jeff, we're on Rumble, right?
Yes, we are. I saved this question for the free speech portion of the show.
Thanks. Olivia, with all due respect, it's total fucking bullshit. There, I said it. You don't know anything about Russia if you're making that statement. You're simply repeating garbage that comes from people who have an agenda against Russia. Vladimir Putin, there are plenty of people who disagree with Vladimir Putin's policies today in Russia. Many of them are in the Duma. Many of them belong to parties that are opposed to Vladimir Putin. When he runs for office, there are people on the ballot who get votes. That means that it's not vote for Putin, it's a vote for them. When you say that he pursues the opposition, let's be clear, the opposition he pursues is not a Russian opposition, but an opposition funded, created by foreign intelligence services for the purpose of subverting and corrupting and perverting Russian democracy. Navalny is not a Russian Democrat. He's a CIA asset. End of story. He was recruited by the CIA. He's funded by the CIA using direct monies or indirect monies for the sole purpose of undermining democracy in Russia by creating an opposition whose goal it is to bring down Vladimir Putin. Would you say that if the Russians went out and bought a political party and said, ooh, you guys go in and you go up against the, hell, we don't even have to ask this question, because in 2016, The Democrats accused the Russians of buying a political party. The Republicans, they accused the president of colluding with the Russians. And everybody said it is a frontal assault on democracy. The difference is, of course, that Russia never did any such thing. This was a figment of the imagination of the Democrats. But the CIA did buy Navalny and the opposition people. So guess what happens when you betray your country? You get crushed. And Navalny got crushed. Is this anti-democracy? Nope. It's called preserving Russia. It's the West that has destroyed democracy. You know, you keep my kid's pregnant three times a year. She blames Putin. I do too.
That's not a question, by the way, Princess.
I know it's a statement, but it does say question.
I know. It's not even necessary when it is a question. Now she's putting it when it's not even a question.
Come that's on, okay.
Princess.
That's,
but get
that's
your funny. Act together, Princess. All right.
That's funny enough. My point is this, you know, Russian democracy never existed in the 1990s. Anybody who believes it does only has to look at Boris Yeltsin, who put tanks on the streets of Moscow to fire shells into the Russian parliament in October of 1993, or look at the 1996 election, which Time magazine did a cover story on the best election money can buy, because we bought that election. We, the United States of America, bought that election. So you're sitting here saying that Putin's a dictator because he's crushing a CIA effort to undermine Russian democracy. You're smoking dope. You're high. But more than that, you're wrong. Dead wrong. Damn wrong. Okay. I'll calm down. You didn't get up.
You tried. I stopped. I heard you stop talking. So I stopped the clock in the middle of a whip. That is the sort of precise timing that we're all about here. Now, this nice person, I think it was the same person who asked the question, says, I'm an ignorant fool because I didn't know Mauritius is an island. Well, I may be an ignorant fool, but I'm not unnecessarily hostile towards people. Okay, I didn't know it was an island.
But you, wait. With all due respect, though, you did say it could be in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah. Well,
which would technically make it an island.
That's true. But more than that, I said I didn't know. I don't know. So you're not allowed to not know things without getting insulted as an ignorant fool. Mauritius, aren't there a few things you don't know that maybe I know? You think that might be possible? Guess what? I'm not going to call you an ignorant fool.
I'll tell you what, Jeff. No. I know there's things that you know that I don't know. So.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Maria from Kiel. That's in Germany, in case you didn't know, Scott.
Did you know that, Jeff?
Well, as soon as I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Don't trust what you read on Wikipedia, man.
Well, for the non-controversial stuff, you could maybe trust it. What's going to be the future in the standard of living, income, jobs, healthcare, and education in Europe, specifically Germany? That was a little bit of a clue, by the way. I hear doom and gloom, but people are not starving, and most white Germans still have homes, jobs, and healthcare. After all, Germans pulled through the Great Depression.
Yeah, Maria, I'm not going to fight you on this one. Germany is a large country, and there are people who have jobs, there are people who have homes, and there are people for the moment who have health care. But was it Maria? Was that her name? Maria?
Yeah.
But Maria from Kiel in Germany. Would you not agree with me that things today are worse than, say, they were this time 2 years ago? Or you're going to make the case that things are the same. There's no problem. You don't think that there's a deindustrialization process taking place in Germany today. You don't think that Germany is a nation that's lost its rudder, that it's just sort of floating aimlessly in the sea of global existence. You don't think that the Green Party has embarrassed and humiliated Germany, both domestically but on the foreign stage. I'm not a German. I'm an outside observer. I don't have the keen insights that come from living in Germany like you do, living in Kiel. But I have spoken to Germans. I've just spoke to some Germans again in Switzerland. It neighbors Germany, by the way, just in case anybody didn't think I knew that. But I'm sorry. Now I'm in a facetious mood. This is horrible. I apologize. But you attacked Jeff, so you attacked me. Not you, Maria and Kiel. But the point is, I just think Germany's adrift politically, economically, spiritually. I mean, what does Germany stand for, Maria from Kiel? Do you fly the German flag outside your house with pride, like many Americans on my street do? Do you tear up when you see the German flag? What does the German flag mean to you? What does Germany mean to you? Are you willing to die for your country, Maria from Kiel? See, these are questions the Germans need to ask themselves, because I think many Germans forgot what Germany stands for. They can't define it themselves, and therefore they're unable to stand up and defend Germany when Germany needs to be defended. And right now, if you're Maria from Kiel, a German citizen, and you're not in the streets protesting against the German support for the Nazi regime in Ukraine, you know, the ones that support Stepan Bandera and that sort of stuff, then you've sort of lost your own internal moral ethical compass, Maria from Kiel. So, yeah, I think Germany's heading on the wrong path. And if they don't reverse it, there will be collapse.
Okay. If you're interested, it's pronounced Mauritius. I guess that's it. Well, as an ignorant fool, of course I'm not interested. I'm an ignorant fool.
But I'm interested. So thank you, Brother Clark.
Mauritius. Is that it?
Mauritius.
Yeah. All right. Paul D. Wolf.
They didn't run out of gas last winter. What about next winter? Well, Paul D. Wolf, they didn't run out of gas last winter. And thankfully, because it was a mild winter. But last winter, they also, if you remember, Paul D. Wolf, they were buying Russian gas. Remember that, Paul? Before they blew up the pipelines, they were buying Russian gas. And what did they do with that Russian gas, Paul? They filled up their gas reserves, which then, because it was a mild winter, weren't fully depleted. But now, as they roll into the next winter, have they filled up all of that? And if they did, are they using Russian gas? Nope. They're using non-Russian gas, which costs a whole lot more than Russian gas. But, I mean, do you really think it's sound economic planning to go through each winter rolling the dice whether or not you're going to have a mild winter? I guess if you're betting on global warming, that's the safe bet. But what happens if this winter becomes a very harsh winter, Paul D. Wolf, and they run out of gas? I don't think there's a nation out there that should be running on that kind of margin. Do you, Paul? I don't think so. I think that the Germans are paying a price. Ask yourself, Paul D. Wolf, why German industry is shutting down? Why is that, Paul D. Wolf? Is it because they ran out of gas? Nope. It's because the price of gas is too high. They can't keep paying the energy bill in energy hungry industries, Paul D. Wolf. So they... See, I'm being mean, Jeff. You got to stop me when I do this. Hit me. You got to come up with a preemptive whip. The whip, the whip that says you're being an asshole. As soon as I start crossing the, because Paul asked a question, and here I took it personally, but
you're still angry about our friend in the island.
I am. So Paul, I apologize.
All right, here's another comment from the island, dude. Triggered, my friend. Oh yeah, I love it when people think they've scored some kind of a victory because somebody might be angry. If that's a victory in your life, getting me a little bit irritated, you don't. You should maybe set your sights higher.
But now here's the question. This love from Curacao.
Oh, yeah.
Where is that?
Oh, God. I'm an ignorant fool. Why are you even asking me? You're not much better if you expect to get a good answer out of an ignorant
fool. I was hoping to get a good answer out of you because I think I know where it is, but I'm not going to say it live because then I'll just
Curacao,
show
in the West Indies. I have no idea where. Oh, you don't know. Okay. All right. Don't get me triggered. You know how I am when I'm triggered. Anything happens. All bets off.
Paul, I just want to point out that Paul, that the German industry, Germany's in the process of deindustrialization. One of the main reasons is because of high energy prices. And that's because they don't have access to cheap Russian gas anymore.
A Jordanian guy in Ankara. Can Russia use social media to reason with Ukrainian soldiers and prove how worthless it is to keep dying in a meat grinder in spite of their courage? Logically, if you're facing one of the largest and most powerful armies in the world, you need a bigger motivation than NATO praise and promises.
But Russia is doing this. If you go on, you know, Telegram is a social media platform that is very prominent in Russia and in Ukraine. And, you know, there are numerous pro-Ukrainian Telegram channels, pro-Russian Telegram channels, and many of these Russian Telegram channels are affiliated with the Russian government. And what you'll see on there are some interesting, first of all, they're always posting interviews of Ukrainian soldiers who've surrendered. And the Ukrainian soldiers are talking about how well they've been treated, how the Russians feed them, take care of their wounds, do things like that. Tell that guy to take a powder world-class peckerwood. Me? Okay.
No, probably the guy who's harassing me for being a fool. I like to think it's more people coming to my defense. Let's assume that's what it is.
Okay, we're just going to assume that Rocker's on our side. Okay. We get to interpret this one. But gosh, I just lost my train of thought. We were talking about, propaganda. So they're interviewing the Ukrainian prisoners of war, and they're making it appear as if, you know, if you surrender, you're going to be well treated, et cetera. They've also come out with a slick new ad that shows a young kid, and he turns around, charges, gets hit in the head, he's dead. And they said, you know, you didn't have to do that. You could have turned around and, you know, surrendered and lived. So they put that one out there. It was so effective that the Ukrainians actually went in and photoshopped out the Ukrainian flag and put the Russian flag in there, and they're playing it back to the Russians. And then there's another thing they do. I forget the exact code name, but they said, you know, tune your radio frequency to 149.183, you know, Volga, and call out. And if you call out, you will get an answer, and they'll tell you how to surrender and work your way through. So the Russians are actually putting a full court press on trying to convince Ukrainian soldiers to surrender rather than die.
Okay. Raiders 2021 says too much attempt at comedy. Well, since you're such an expert at Raiders 2021, it would be helpful if you were to say exactly how far over the line we went, because you're an expert on how much is too much. So if you could get back to us with where to draw the line, then we'll be as humorless in the future as you want. What were you going to say?
No. But Raiders should know, you know, the origins of this show. When Jeff and I were first talking about this, I did say, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, because I am old and senile, but didn't I say that one of our motivations, or one of the things that we could look to for inspiration, was the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson?
Absolutely.
So comedy was always, because let me just say this. Are we on the clock?
No. Just take all the time you want. I like it. Go, Inspector, go.
Let me just say this. I do this all the time, meaning that I talk. I do interviews all the time. And these are very hard subjects, very difficult subjects. And they wear you down. They wear you down emotionally. They wear you down mentally. And when Jeff said, Scott, let's do something together. What did I say, Jeff? I'm not inclined to do this because I'm worn out, literally worn out. And but then we talked about it and I said, okay, if we can do this, but keep it a little lighter than the other ones, that we're not trying to trivialize a topic. We're not trying to dumb it down with, you know, bad humor, et cetera. But but we are trying to keep it light, have a little fun if we can, because, hey, guys, this stuff's depressing. War is not a pick-me-up kind of thing. It's not something that you talk about 24/7 and walk away feeling good. I'd like to believe at the end of these shows, unless Jeff puts too many trigger questions, that when I hang up, I actually feel pretty good about it. I talk about it with my wife and we're like, hey, that was a fun show. That was a good show. People learned something from the show. And that's the goal. That's the objective. But if you want to make this a serious show, then you're probably, and everybody agreed with that, then I would probably stop doing this show, because I don't want to do another serious show. I want to do what we're doing. I think it's pretty, we're going to try and fix it up, make it better, do whatever. We're just sort of winging it. You know, Jeff's the pro here. He's got all the producer skills. We're just winging it. But we're not over the top on humor. We're not trying to make this a comedy show. But I liken this to some, you know, guys sitting at a bar after a long days of work talking through the issues. But you got to do it with a little bit of humor, or else you go insane.
Yeah. People who don't do this, I don't think they fully appreciate that when you're speaking extemporaneously. Is that the right word? Extemporaneously.
That's a good word.
by definition, it's going to be imperfect, right? So unless somebody is way off on, say, the humor or whatever it might be, you know, allow for the imperfections. And maybe it's not your cup of tea. Watch Scott on the other shows where it's more serious. Judge Knapp, for example, doesn't joke around, and he does a great show.
He does a great show, but it's a different format. It's a different show. This, I think you and I have a very unique approach to covering, you know, difficult topics, and I think we do it very well, and I'm proud of the show, I do look forward to doing it.
Same here, and I appreciate the nice comments coming on Rumble. I can't really keep up with all of them because I am alone today. And that's about it for this week, by the way. Let's remind folks that if you want to order Scott's book, autographed by the author himself, you can go to scottrittermerch.com. That's Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika, autographed by Scott himself. And also at that same website, Scott Ritter Merch, we're selling that smart-looking T-shirt modeled by the very hunky Ryan Milton in Austin. And that will do it for this week's edition of the Lightning Round. Every Tuesday, we do it from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern time. Scott experiencing an earthquake now, apparently. What are you pointing at?
Again, I just want to thank the people at Mut zur Ethik, Eva Maria, Erica Moritz, and the entire crowd. Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a tremendous couple days. Patrick Lawrence, I want to thank you, and Cara, your lovely wife, for everything. I want to thank everybody that was there, Jeff. It was really a remarkable weekend. We kept it sort of low key because there were some current concerns that, you know, we know what happens when you put Scott Ritter's name on a bill. The crazies come out of the woodwork, and the idea was to keep the crazies away from this place. So we didn't advertise it and such, but, yeah, I would just ask people to look them up on the internet. They publish some really good stuff, and it's an outstanding organization. It does really good work.
Okay. I got a few emails from people in Switzerland asking where they could find you, and I did answer a couple of them. I'm sorry if I didn't get to everybody, and it wasn't because we were being secretive. It's because the organizers had security concerns and asked for it to not be publicized. Join us on Friday night for the loquacious version at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Scott will spend about 2 hours as per usual. That'll be my final podcast episode as a resident of California, episode 96, and then 4 more episodes until the big milestone. Let's take it out tonight with Bobby Zimmerman, a.k.a. Dylan, a little bit of that version of Hard Rain that you like so much, recorded in concert in Japan, backed by an orchestra. Thanks to our beloved audience. See you Friday night.